Kelly.
But welcome to the Luke Jones breakfast meeting. Breakfast is a vestigial term because there's no food here. I guess you all have your oatmeal at home. There used to be food here. But anyway, welcome. We don't have these as often enough as we probably ought to. Spin those creative juices, and if you have an idea of a topic you'd like to present, even people on the screens at our five remote locations, you could present as well, and we'd all benefit. Today we have panelists from the U.S. Trustee's Office presenting on due diligence in consumer cases. Attorneys Michelle Kramer, Laura Steele, Amy Ginsberg, and other staff people from the office, I think Vince Morelli and Mary Kay McSherry.
That's correct.
Good job. Yeah! Oh, name's right.
Okay, take it away.
Thank you, Judge Hannon. Good morning. My name is Michelle Kramer. I'm one of the trial attorneys with the United States Trustee's Office. We're excited for the opportunity to present today, and we hope to elicit a lot of conversation about our topic. We want to especially thank Chief Judge Kelly for the invitation to present, and thank you, Judge Hannon, for presiding. I'd like to introduce the rest of the UST team. We have, as Judge Hannon said, Laura Steele and Amy Ginsberg are the other trial attorneys. Vince Morelli is our auditor, and Mary Kay McSherry is our analyst. Our goal this morning is to highlight pitfalls that put debtors, dischargers at risk, and attorneys' fees at risk. And in many cases, further exploration during the client intake phase would resolve a number of issues that we see on the back end. When you do the due diligence on the front end and explore all of the topics that you're going to see highlighted here, it gives you all, the attorneys, more options on the front end, whereas after the case is filed, some of those options no longer exist for you. So here's a roadmap of today's discussion. Amy is going to start off with the means test. She's going to discuss the means test and some current issues that we're seeing there. Laura is then going to discuss the schedules and areas of due diligence in that area. And then Vince and Mary Kay are going to present case studies and then give examples from their perspective. Each section is going to be about 15 minutes, and we've built in time for questions. We invite you to ask questions as we go along. We want this to be very interactive and conversational because one of the key factors that we find is that when we have communication with the attorneys, it really goes a long way in trying to resolve cases or issues or just being educational from both ends. We want to thank Laura for her efforts in drafting the outline that you have for our discussion, and it's just meant to offer guidance when interviewing clients. And as you know, all cases are fact-specific. And when you call us, we can't give you the answer on your case, but we can certainly work through the issues with you. And we always invite phone calls to try and go through those issues beforehand instead of having to answer a complaint or a motion on the back end. So without further ado, we'll let Amy start off. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Amy Ginsberg. Most of you know me. And hello to everybody there in TV land. As most of you know, I'm a native of Brooklyn, so please feel free to interrupt me. Either I'll keep on going or I'll take your question. Just to highlight the conversational part of this. When we start out with the means test, one of the first questions that's asked on the means test is, how many people are in the debtor's household? And lately, we've noticed that households have been growing in size. And the benefit to the debtor is, you know, the bigger the household, the easier it is to pass the means test. And people are adding in adult children, cousins in faraway places, grandparents, grandchildren. So what we look at when a debtor is claiming more than, including adults over 18, and other people who the debtor is not legally obligated to support, like a spouse. The UST applies an economic unit approach to define the debtor's household size. An economic unit is a broad inquiry to see whether the other members of the household combine their income, share their expenses, and they are mutually obligated to support each other. They may not be legally obligated, but between them or among themselves, they are mutually obligated to support each other. We're looking at unmarried couples. Sometimes there's a parent and child. The inquiry, of course, is fact-intensive. And one of the things we look at is, are all the members of the economic unit interdependent, or do they function more like roommates, such as your adult child who's living at home and uses their income to pay their bills but lives off the generosity of the parents? And I'll go through a little more, but that's an example of someone who is probably not part of the economic unit, which is the household of the debtor. Some of the facts we look at are there joint bank accounts? Are there joint bills? We'll look at the car insurance declaration sheet. If they're a household or an economic unit, they probably have all the cars on the same insurance policy. We look at joint use of property, such as, you know, it doesn't matter which car you take in the morning. So we look for the mutual obligations. And that can be done, again, in a variety of ways, such as if you've got an unmarried couple and one is paying the mortgage and one is paying the utilities and other there are many ways that you can demonstrate that people living together are an economic unit. But the important thing is that Schedule J needs to be consistent with the economic unit. So if somebody else is paying the mortgage and the debtor is only paying the other household bills, we would expect on Schedule J for there to be no mortgage expense. Or the other way to do it is you have to disclose everybody's income. Everyone who you're claiming is part of the economic unit, you need to disclose their income. And we find this frequently comes up with adult children. And remember, once a child turns 18, the debtor is not legally obligated to support that adult child. If you claim an adult child as part of the debtor's economic unit, don't be surprised to receive a request from us for a copy of the adult child's tax returns and bank statements. Is that person you're claiming as part of the economic unit, are they paying the household bills or their own car payment, their own insurance? Adult child would not be part of the economic unit from the United States trustee's perspective. Here's a case study. There were two adults who were married in their 50s. They had two grown children in their 20s, and then the two adult children had two minor children. So we have grandparents who were the debtors, adult children, and two minor children. The debtors claimed a six-person household and claimed the adult children were full-time students. After I asked for the debtors' children, I asked for their proof that they were full-time students and copies of their tax returns. When we got the tax returns, the adult children were making, one was making $25,000 a year, the other was making $30,000 a year. The adults claimed their children as dependents on their own tax return so they could get the earned income tax credit, and they didn't contribute that earned income tax credit to the household. The adult children didn't contribute anything to the household. And when I asked about proof that they were full-time students, I got proof that each one was taking one class. And the adult children didn't contribute any money to the economic unit, so I filed a motion to dismiss, and the case was dismissed. Because once you use a two-person household, the presumption arose and couldn't be rebutted. When people claim their grandchildren as dependents, I always look into whether who claimed the grandchildren as dependents on their tax returns. Because usually the parents have lower income and they want that earned income tax credit. So, and then the adult children will keep that earned income tax credit to themselves. And from my perspective, those adult children and the grandchildren are not part of the economic unit because they're living off the generosity of the debtor, but they're not in turn contributing to the household income and paying some of the household expenses. Another case study, the debtor was single. He lived with his ex-wife and ex-wife's 19-year-old grandson. The debtor paid all the household bills, despite the fact his ex-wife was working, and the grandson was employed too. But the debtor claimed a household of three for the means test. The ex-wife and the grandson are not part of the economic unit because they didn't contribute any of their income to the household expenses. The ex-wife and the grandson were living off the debtor's generosity. And when somebody lives off somebody else's generosity, that's not part of the economic unit. This case converted to Chapter 13. Another case study. Just because somebody says somebody's a dependent, sometimes you need to inquire. I had a case where the debtor claimed her disabled mother was a dependent, but the mother didn't receive Social Security disability income. And I found it curious that someone who's disabled wasn't collecting Social Security disability. Upon further investigation, I found out the mother was not disabled, living in Las Vegas. She was registered to vote in Las Vegas, and she was a certified tax preparer preparing tax returns. So this mother was not part of the debtor's economic unit. And that case was, the debtor lost her discharge for lying about the fact that claiming her mother was her dependent. So moving on from what is the debtor's household size, the debtor's gross income. And if you take a look at the first page of the handout, on B towards the bottom, the debtor's current monthly income includes any amount paid by any entity other than the debtor on a regular basis for the household expenses of the debtor or the debtor's dependents. Judge Helfinger has a case where he held that the parents of the debtor who received Social Security, the parents' income, who was part of the economic unit, was part of the debtor's income for the purpose of the means test. Because the statute says only excludes benefits under the Social Security Act that go to the debtor, not somebody else. So once you have a relative who receives Social Security income and you're claiming that relative is part of the economic unit, that income comes in. And the other thing I want to highlight about B, it says it doesn't say what is taxable income. And there's a lot of income that people receive which is not taxable. Workers' comp, disability insurance payments, there can be gifts or trust payments that a debtor receives on a regular basis, foster care payments, guardianship payments, and regular contributions from family members, roommates, parents. I was going through a debtor's bank statements and asked him at a 2004 exam, what is this $500? The debtor was employed at the post office. It's like, what are these regular deposits of $500 a month in your bank account? He said, my parents pay me $500 a month to live with me. I'm like, Where's that in the schedules? And in a case like that, there were some other extenuating circumstances here, but a debtor who fails to disclose that they're getting $500 a month, that's lying about their income, and that can cost your clients their discharge. When looking at income, please make sure to look at the debtor's pay stubs. I had a case recently where if you just looked at the debtor's pay stubs, the income was woefully understated. The income on year-to-date was off by $10,000, and the monthly income was off between $500 and $600 a month. And I think that attorney didn't even compare the pay stubs to what he put on Schedule I, and that attorney voluntarily disgorged his fee. Now we're going to get to some little specifics on the means test, which is part of your handout. Lines 12 and 13, if the debtor owns an unencumbered vehicle that's more than 6 years old, this is the junker exception, the debtor has no ownership expense, but the debtor can take an additional $200 on line 11. And if you use best case, as long as you click on the right boxes, best case will do this for you. You'll get an extra $200 a month additional operating expenses. But a word of caution, on Schedule J, which asks for your transportation expenses, you don't automatically carry $200 of additional operating expenses onto Schedule J. Schedule J asks, what are your actual transportation expenses, including gas, oil, and repairs? So those are two different inquiries. Okay, moving along to line 16, taxes. Line 16 asks for the debtor's actual tax obligations, not what is the debtor withholding. So if you've got a debtor that gets a substantial tax refund, you need to adjust from what the debtor's withholding on Schedule I to the debtor's actual expenses on line 16. And you also need to take a look at the prior year's tax returns, which are usually counsel's starting point, but sometimes the debtor has had an unusual tax year. For example, if they took a 401k distribution and had to pay taxes on penalties, that's probably something that's not going to happen going forward. So you need to adjust if the debtor had special tax issues in the prior year. Line 17, involuntary deductions. Involuntary. This doesn't include where a debtor has no choice. It means union dues, uniforms, not 401k loan payments. Line 29, education expenses for minor children. These are education expenses. School fees, lab fees, if they're taking an art class, art fees. Okay, I'm running out of time. Not camp, school lunches, sports, dance lessons. Those are not education expenses. Okay, I'm going to skip to line, I think it's 34. Line 34 allows a debtor to cure an arrearage for a piece of secured property that they intend to keep that is both necessary for their support or the support of their dependents. So no boat payments, ATV payments. And the other thing is that they're surrendering the property, such as the car or the house, then they can't take the deduction, the cure amount on line 34 because they're surrendering their property. So it's not necessary for their support. And then you've gone through your means test. Best case gives you the little frowny face, and the presumption arises. Now the presumption can rebut the presumption, but you have to have something serious. The examples in the statute are serious medical condition, a call to active, military duty. We're looking for something that's beyond the debtor's control, and unique to this debtor. So 401k loan payments. Okay, I'm done. 401k loan payments.
Ending on something I totally disagree with, but go
okay,
ahead.
Okay, that's I can take it.
There are case law. There's case law that says it doesn't have to be beyond the debtor's control. That's
arguable. I'm saying that's what we look for.
That's what you look for. Okay.
And just the information needs to be quantified. Well, in one case, we got a rebuttal that said side income unreliable. That's not very helpful. Property taxes will increase in the future. Yeah, everybody's taxes will increase in the future. And in one case, we got a rebuttal that the debtor's income decreased from $12,000 a month to $9,000 a month. The presumption still arose at $9,000 a month.
Right.
And I'm done.
Yeah, I'm
done.
And just to kind of carry off on Amy on that point, we do require the rebuttal of the presumption of abuse to actually be filed and signed by the debtor. We've gotten some feedback that there was maybe some impression that these rebuttals didn't have to be filed. There is a piece on the statement or the means test itself where you can list those circumstances. The debtor signature is below. But if for some reason you're not including those special circumstances on the form itself, it needs to be a filed document sworn under penalty of perjury by the debtor, not the attorney. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the schedules and the Statement of Financial Affairs and the reasons you guys get those lovely emails titled Inquiry of the United States Trustee, which I know you all love hearing from us, with your very busy schedules and limited staff and resources. We're aware of that, and that's a big reason why we wanted to have you guys here today, is because we recognize that you don't have the staff that you used to, and you don't have the resources that you used to, and we want to just point out things that we think are pretty obvious, and I think a lot of the questions we ask are things that if you had taken a moment to look with your client and say, hey, this doesn't make sense, you know, we wouldn't be sending these inquiries or might be sending less sort of involved inquiries. So I want to start with Schedule A, B. The first item, of course, is listing everything the debtor owns or has an illegal or equitable interest, even items the debtor is believed to have only sentimental value. I think Judge Kelly's case in In re Green is a really interesting case where the debtors listed $3,500 in personal property. Then it turned out Paul Swanson was the trustee. There was over $200,000 worth of Beanie Babies. So that was 2007. I'm not sure what the market is for Beanie Babies anymore. But, you know, that's something the debtor didn't believe or for maybe other reasons didn't disclose and turned out to be a very large asset for the estate. So, again, people might not think that things are of value, but you need to go through the house and say what's in this house. And if you've got, I think it was about 40 pallets of Beanie Babies, that's something to disclose. The other item is to report the current value of the portion of the property the debtor owns. Please note that intentional undervaluation of assets will result in us bringing an action for denial of discharge. So really give some consideration as to how you're valuing property. When you're talking about your household items, please be specific. Don't say household goods, furniture, you know, and especially if these are large value items or something that when we look at EF, there's a debt to Steinhoffels. There's a debt to Pottery Barn for $5,000 recently, and you listed $100 in household goods. That doesn't make sense. What happened to that furniture? That's when we get these inquiries going to you. I thought the In re Baker case out of the Northern District of Illinois is also interesting. The debtors try to defend a denial of discharge action by stating, or they had failed to list about 100 fish tanks, and their argument was that they included it in their household items category, but that was something that did not fly as an argument to the court, and that one of the debtors did lose his discharge. Jewelry, please be specific. Don't say miscellaneous jewelry, $5,000. You know, what does that include? Has any of that property been appraised recently? Is it insured? Is it on an insurance rider? I recently had a case where a discharge was waived because the debtors listed $500 in jewelry and had $35,000 in insured jewelry on their insurance rider. So those are, you know, some real...
Didn't the debtor also remove the Rolex? Is that the case where the debtor removed the Rolex and thought we wouldn't find out about it?
Right, yeah, there's... Right. We're going to ask for, if we see, you know, if we have some questions about this, there are documents, and we're going to ask for those documents, and those documents don't lie. So, you know, if someone's trying to play games with assets or property, we're going to ask questions about that. Deposits of money. this is a big thing, too. We see a lot, maybe even more so lately, just seeing accounts at Associated Bank total $500. Well, how many accounts do you have? And this is something that was kind of surprising to me in that Schedule AB does not require listing out of the actual last four digits of the account numbers, but that is something that is helpful to us. You know, if later on we question whether or not the debtor has actually disclosed a bank account, having those on there, I think, would clarify things and probably do a service to your client. And I don't think that you're violating any sort of privacy issues by including the last four digits of that bank account. So just please note that try not to lump those accounts and separate them out. That's helpful for us and to your client. And also just make sure that those values on AB make sense with the rest of the schedules. So especially looking at D and C, do all these things make sense in like sort of a global view? Moving on to Schedule D, secured creditors, think about the friends and relatives. A lot of times, I just took a 2004 the other day where the debtors didn't consider mom's loan to them, you know, or the down payment on the house, you know, any sort of, and this goes for EF too, didn't consider her a creditor. But of course she is. And so you need to ask these questions and find out who the debtor owes debts to and, you know, whether or not they're unsecured or secured. You need to really kind of thoroughly go through that with the client. For EF, again, consider the friends, relatives. Anyone trying to collect a debt from the debtor, this is also probably a good place to kind of think about any lawsuits that the debtor has to bring or to defend. Also, the biggest thing on EF is listing the dates when the debts were incurred. We see a lot of overtime, you know, years, something like that.
And or just blank.
Or just blank. And I can tell you the BPPs in this district have done a better job of listing those dates than a lot of the attorneys that we've seen. So if the BPPs can do it, you guys can do it. So that, again, is going to generate inquiry for us. And I know there's a fee for amending EF. Save your client the fee. Look at that credit report. When is the debt actually incurred? Those are important things to us because if we see a case where there are no blanks, we're going to ask for that amendment, especially if there's large credit card debts, things like that. It's going to raise a flag for us to ask questions. And I know Vince wanted to chime in on this one as one of his favorite points is that a lot of times we'll make inquiries for bank statements and credit card statements, and then what the response we'll get is, oh, the accounts are closed. We can't access them. And this is something that creates a delay for your clients. It creates more expenses for you. So consider my point here is consider saving those statements when you're meeting with your client. Ask them to save 6 months of those statements so they're ready to go, and you don't have to go back to the credit card company after the account is closed. And I think Vince has some requests about how those are generated to us.
Yeah, ideally, if you can have your clients go and print those directly to PDF from the website, the credit card website, the bank website. That's going to ensure completeness of the statements, and it's an easier format for us to work with when we're going through the statements to analyze those. So we prefer print direct to PDF over a paper scan copy.
And the faster we can get them and review them, frequently we decide we're not going to take any further action, but that's a benefit to your client because you stand a greater chance of it not affecting. Delaying their discharge.
Also moving on to Schedule I, please review those pay advices like Amy was saying. Think about other sources of income. There's a lot of debtors who are doing Uber, a lot of debtors who are doing these side businesses on Facebook, cosmetics, things like that. That's income. We want to know about it and it should be disclosed. Again, contributions from roommates and adult children. Think about what those children or roommates are contributing to the household. That is also something that needs to be disclosed on I. Please be sure, if a debtor is running a business, that you include the Schedule I-8, and that is a listing of the gross income and the expenses to get to a net number that's included on I. If we don't have that information about how the debt, you know, it could be a rental property, it could be, you know, just a small business that they're running, but that information needs to be there so we understand how you're getting to your net income number for the debtor.
And it's required by the schedules.
Right.
And I think there's an argument that we can move to dismiss your case, the debtor's case, if that information isn't provided because it's required by the schedules. And the schedules are incomplete without that information.
Let's see. Moving on to your expenses, please note that if the debtors are living separately, we get this a lot, debtors are divorcing, you know, they have separate households. Well, how do we know that unless you're telling us information about what those separate household expenses are? And there's a form for that, IO6J2, which is on the U.S. Bankruptcy Court's website. So please use that. It's very helpful to us. Statement of Financial Affairs. A big thing, especially more so, I think, with cases where debtors are running businesses, is the disclosure of gross income. We get a lot of net income disclosed here, and that raises questions for us when we know you're running a daycare or something with a larger operation and you're disclosing minimal income. And I think Vince wanted to chime in on this one, too.
Yes, we've seen a couple instances where people use zeros as placeholders, or they haven't quite calculated what gross income is, so they use zeros there. Zero has a very specific meaning to us as reviewers of the schedules, so please consider not using that. And then also, if you have a debtor who owns a business, consider the type of entity that business is. Is it S-Corp, LLC? There's going to be different ways that the debtor could pull money out of that entity that we might consider income, and maybe they don't think of as income or aren't maybe disclosing 100%. So consider the type of entity, too, please.
And so not only are wages something that need to be disclosed or operated from a business, but also any other income. So again, Amy kind of talked about this too, consider child support, Social Security, you know, whether or not that income is taxable. Again, think about the global sort of view on these schedules. Does the means test, does the Statement of Financial Affairs, do all these things make sense? And sort of, you know, take that sort of bird's eye view of the case and think about whether everything is disclosed where it's supposed to be. And I realize there's a lot of moving parts when you're putting a case together, but it's really important, and that's what raises questions for us is when we see discrepancies. So please note that that's something we're thinking about when we're looking at your client's case.
And if I could add something there, when you're talking about Schedule I income and on the sofa when you're talking about your gross income, you can put your net, but the instructions require you to put your gross. So I know that there's a lot of angst about just putting the gross when the net is the more realistic, and that's fine. You can put your net, but we want to also see the gross to see how you got to your net. All right.
Moving on, lawsuits within a year. Again, this is something that's really important to disclose. If we find out later on that the debtor has some sort of PI settlement and there was a case pending during the case and they get a nice cash payout, that's something that is going to come back to kind of haunt them. So either, you know, revocation of a discharge, if we find out after the discharge has been entered, certainly the trustee is going to be interested in whatever assets are happening there. So, again, you know, look at CCAP. Ask the debtor, you know, do you have any lawsuits pending? And maybe they're not filed in Wisconsin. Maybe, you know, but you need to have that conversation because there are real ramifications for not disclosing that information.
Or maybe the lawsuit, maybe they're in negotiations and there's another lawsuit. The question might be, have you hired an attorney to represent you in any other matter? Might get you the answer that'll help your client.
And also going back to the separate household thing, so the debtors are getting a divorce. List the divorce, because sometimes we, you know, we're told this and maybe it's not been filed yet, and that's one thing. But you know, it helps us to know that there's a divorce pending and that this is really a separating household situation. Gifts within 2 years, you know, ask the debtors about these gifts that they're giving to family members, you know, that sort of thing. And then going on to charitable contributions, again, this is sort of a global view. Does the disclosure of the charitable contributions make sense with the deduction on the means test and Schedule J? You know, does this all make sense, or did the debtor suddenly just become very charitable and is trying to, you know, to kind of scapegoat things that way? Gambling, we like to see that 721 Canal Street address on bank statements, and you know, you should be kind of have ears up for that too. Ask for those W-2Gs, you know, if this is a concern, if you got a debtor who's got a history of gambling, we want to know about that. Payments regarding your bank, regarding bankruptcy, question number 16. This is all payments that this client has given you. So whether you've represented the debtor in a foreclosure action or some other civil suit, you need to disclose that, because we're looking at, you know, how much has this debtor paid you. A lot of times we'll see debt settlement firms, and sometimes some attorneys, I've had one case where an attorney was doing a debt settlement and then that didn't work out and he filed the bankruptcy, but he didn't disclose the debt settlement. And guess what? His $5,000 in fees in the debt settlement program were disgorged, and he had to pay them back to the debtor. So, you know, this is not only putting your client at risk, these questions, but it's also you having to deal with us doing a 329 action or something like that. So, again, really have these ears up, the things that we're going to, you know, ask about, and just make sure everything is disclosed, all your interactions with this debtor. How am I doing on the time, Michelle?
You're good.
Okay.
I have 2 minutes.
Okay, great. let's see. You guys are very quiet, too. I'm not getting any questions. Let's see. Transfers within 2 years, you know, think about those cars that they might have sold or traded in, or, you know, just really ask these questions of your debtor. Closed financial accounts, if we see someone has liquidated a 401k in the past year, okay, that's a closed financial account. It should be listed here. So think about these things. And a lot of times debtors are moving bank accounts because maybe they're having trouble with this one bank and moving along. Did I see a question over there? No. Okay.
Wishful thinking.
I know. So really, I mean, again, these are things to think about. You know, look at where you're getting paid from. You know, is this an account that is new, or, you know, just ask these questions. Connections to a business. There's resources here in the state, the DFI. It's pretty easy to look up if someone's been a registered agent for an LLC or something like that. So please be looking at those if your debtor's been operating businesses. All business interests need to be disclosed. It doesn't matter that the debtor, you know, decided to stop running it a year ago. We're going to find it, and we're going to ask you questions about it. And, you know, please just end run us and just put it down there.
And we've found in many cases where the debtor says the business is closed and not operating, but the debtor is still using the business bank account.
Right. So I'd say, just to kind of my sort of parting thoughts here too, is, you know, if, especially with the presumption cases, we had a lot of debtors who have health issues and things like that, and maybe you don't want to disclose that. We certainly don't want to put debtors through something that they don't want to put out there in the public. So if there's something that, you know, this debtor's got something going on and I don't want to put on the docket, call us. Please let us know what's going on. And, you know, we don't know the facts of the cases like you guys do. So, you know, really my point is save your client the risk of losing your discharge. Save yourself the risk of losing your fees. And really just disclose everything and call us if there are any special issues.
All right. So I'm going to go through a case that we had here in Milwaukee just to kind of illustrate some of the things that Amy and Laura talked about and try to give you a little bit of insight into where my head's at when I'm reviewing the case and some things you can maybe do to prevent any queries from us.
Can everyone hear Ben?
Okay. Louder, Vince.
I'll speak up. As an accountant, it's one thing we're not trained to do is public speak.
He was really happy when I told him he got to do this.
Yeah, as happy as I was. I'm excited to be here. All right, so this was a Chapter 7 case where the debtor was the sole owner of a business. On the sofa, gross income for the prior 2 years was listed as $15,000 for the recent year, and it was listed as $16,800 and $15,000 for the prior year. So just that one question I'm asking, is this gross income or is this the business's net income? The type of entity was not disclosed on the SOFA or anywhere else in the schedules for that matter. So again, if this is net income, what type of entity is this? Has the owner's salary been deducted to arrive at this net income figure? Really kind of what's the owner of the business able to pull from this company in cash or other wealth? And then what's the correct number for the prior year? Is it $16,800 or $15,000? Or did the debtor have multiple sources of income from the prior year, potentially owned a different business that wasn't disclosed, or had a job? So where are these numbers coming from, and what are they actually? On Schedule I, the debtor listed income of $2,000 a month, but on the means test, the debtor listed $0 in income. So now I get that these cover different time periods, but now what's going through my head is in the past they earned money, they project to earn money going forward, but during the means test period they're not earning any money. Explanation there would have helped out a lot as to help me bring peace in my own mind.
Well, and that's something, Vince, too, like the attorney should have maybe thought about too, like, does this globally make sense, right?
Yeah, bingo. Yep, exactly. So Yep, exactly. All right, so we made an inquiry for tax returns and bank statements, which if you've gotten my inquiries in the past, you might be thinking that they got off pretty easy. But upon review of the bank statements, I noticed a couple things that raised a few more questions. So the deposits were inconsistent with the income reported, any of the three incomes, I guess, reported on that on those schedules. There was a lack of normal expenses, such as utilities and groceries or food, in these bank statements. And there were a lot of transfers to and from a PayPal account. So we requested these PayPal account statements and found that the debtor was invoicing, collecting money, and dispersing money for business and personal expenses through the PayPal account. So this was like their primary kind of operating account. They were using the bank account to transfer PayPal funds into and then pull cash for walking around money.
It is possible to use, and we're running into this now, is to use a PayPal account instead of a bank account.
Yep. So so when you're looking at these deposits of money and the schedules, what to disclose there, consider PayPal accounts, consider Coinbase accounts, these altcoin accounts, different places that a debtor's wealth can be that maybe weren't so much of an issue a few years ago. So there were some other issues with this case as well. And then on the PayPal account, the username for the PayPal account was another business name. So we have now potentially an undisclosed business, undisclosed deposit of money, and underreported income. So the debtor's attorney and our attorney corresponded, and the debtor ultimately ended up waiving his discharge. So what's the point of me going through this? I think there's a couple things that an attorney could do on the front end that would have kind of alleviated this, I don't know, our inquiries, maybe address them on the front end. So just typical auditor practices that you might be able to implement on cases. So the first practice is verification. So I grew up in the public accounting world, and we would often have to verify information from clients. And it's not we're accusing them of something. I believe what you're saying, just show me. It's kind of like trust but verify, or what else would we say, a lame accountant joke, pretend like I'm from Missouri and you got to show me the records. I appreciate it. Thank you.
We didn't practice that.
Yeah. ad-lib in here. All right. So, for example, hey, client, use your bank records to show me a couple months where you averaged $2,000 of income in a month. So if the attorney would have done that in this case, he would have seen that the bank records that were provided to our office were not able to substantiate $2,000 a month. There's maybe, I don't know, say $500 to $700 a month in transfers into this, or deposits into this bank account. So then the attorney's question, well, you're telling me this income exists, it's not in this bank account, what's happening, where are you getting this money, where's it being deposited? That would have led him to find the PayPal account. So now the debtor's attorney has the opportunity to disclose the PayPal account to kind of verify what the income actually is. And he, depending on the level of diligence he looked at the PayPal account statements with, he would have seen that, hey, look, maybe there's another business here that the debtor hasn't told me about yet.
Hey, Vince, I'm going to hand you a note that says 1 minute.
Okay. I'll look forward to getting that. I like documentation. So, yeah, I appreciate it. And then the other thing that Laura hit on a bunch is just take a big picture review. Take a step back. You guys are in the details. These questions are very specific. But at the end of the day, all we have to go on is the schedules, and that's what we're looking at. We haven't had conversations with the debtor. We don't know the debtor. We're just looking at this piece of paper, and we want to know, does this story that the schedules are telling us make sense? So you guys have the first opportunity to kind of take a look and ask that question. If I'm just looking at the schedules, does it make sense? So that would be the other recommendation. So trust but verify, and does the story make sense? That's what I got.
Thank you.
You can have some of my time.
You
can finish.
I'm all finished.
I also just sort of chime in there, too. You know, it's that disclosure on the front end is so important because repenting afterward and amending the schedules is not absolving the initial non-disclosure. So, you know, your chance before those debtors put that wet signature on those petition and the schedules is before that's filed with the court. So that's such an important time, and it's not just, well, we're in a rush, and it's, you know, we've got to get this filed, and we'll think about it later. That's not the approach to be taking.
I just wanted to talk about the role of the United States Trustees Program. Our role is not to make your life miserable.
Contrary to popular belief.
Yeah. Our role is really as the watchdog of the bankruptcy system. And I just wanted to let you know, in fiscal year 2016, the United States Trustees Program made 2,158 bankruptcy and bankruptcy-related criminal referrals. Not in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, the entire program, the entire United States. And one of an easy case I thought we could talk about, just to reiterate how important it is to disclose income, is the New Jersey Housewives. I don't know if anybody watches that show, but do you remember that show? Teresa Guiducci gets up. She's in a Chapter 13 case. They file their schedules, and the trustee, after all the testimony, asks Teresa, are you on TV? And she says, yes, I'm on Bravo TV. And he says, where's that income? And that's what led to a 39-count federal indictment. She ends up doing time. Her husband ends up doing time. And bankruptcy fraud is suddenly across, you know, television stations. Had that debtor's attorney listed that income, I talked with a paralegal that started this case, it would have resolved the whole thing. That all initiated because of lack of income on Schedule I, and it was at the 341 hearing. So I wanted to talk a little bit about my favorite case in Milwaukee, in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, and I'll give you some of the facts here. The debtor listed four properties in his Chapter 7 schedules with a combined value of $740,000, and the secured debt was $690,000. All the properties were foreclosed or surrendered. The debtor failed to list four properties or their sale proceeds sold in the year before filing bankruptcy. This information was also forgotten on his tax returns. The total net proceeds were over $200,000. The debtor testified at a 2004 examination that some of the sale proceeds were used for repair work. When we requested documentation or an explanation, one was never provided. Then the United States Trustee's Office gets an anonymous letter stating that the debtor is keeping an undisclosed Harley Davidson in his living room. Mm-hmm. This turns out to be true. We learned that 2 months before the debtor filed bankruptcy, he had transferred the same Harley Davidson to his 85-year-old mother. The address listed on the transfer...
And that's one of the badges of fraud, transferring your Harley to your 85-year-old mother.
She might have really been a Harley fan. Yeah.
She could have been
65. The new 65.
That's right. That was also one of the undisclosed properties. So had they listed the transfer of the Harley Davidson, he might not have gotten in trouble later, but that was also not listed on the SOFRA. There was also a property on his tax returns that wasn't disclosed anywhere on his schedules. He failed to list any of the rental income on his statement of financial affairs from any of the properties. And during the 341 meeting of creditors, he disclosed a Cadillac that wasn't listed on the schedules. And the Chapter 7 trustee eventually sold that Cadillac for over $15,000. So the disclosure was nice. This case actually went to trial. The 85-year-old mother was subpoenaed, and she testified that Harley Davidson was hers. Eventually, the court denied the discharge. And the reason I bring this up, and it is a true case, was that the number of omissions and the amount of the proceeds not disclosed is evidence of a willful omission rather than an innocent mistake. So if it's an innocent mistake, I'm just going to say things that we reiterated. Give us a call. You know, just talk to us about the case. If we're on the wrong track or our request for information is burdensome, just give us a call and we'll talk about it. Maybe we can work something out. Are there any questions, please?
We have 11 minutes, and we saved some time for questions, and we would love to take your questions because a lot of our correspondence is sometimes just one way. We send out our inquiry, and then you guys send responses, and then it's all typing. We're getting less of those phone calls, but we would love to hear from you and just get some feedback with concerns or questions or anything that we've discussed. Anything? Yeah.
When you talk about transfers within 2 years, I asked that for 4 years, and now for a number, because state law will allow you to go back 4 years. And I ran across cases now that say you can go back 10 years if IRS has a claim, because you could stand in their shoes with their 10-year statute of limitations. So,
you mean as a trustee, though?
As a chapter 7 trustee.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm saying I've been asking for a long time about transfers within 10 years, and I think it's important that attorneys ask about that. The second thing that has proved fruitful is to get divorce documents, marital settlement agreements, judgments, and if you can get the financial, because what I find is if one spouse isn't truthful about assets, the other one is. The wife will tell on the husband, or vice versa. And you find coin collections and gun collections and all sorts of things that by the time the other spouse files bankruptcy, suddenly they don't list and they don't exist.
So there's two points from Doug's sort of comment there that I'd like to just sort of touch on too is, please attend the 341 with your client. We get a lot of substitution counsel and things like that, and you are the attorney of record for that client. And if you send someone else, you risk a lot of things. And so please, you know, note that that's not just something ancillary to your representation. That is a big part of your representation, is attending at 341, because there are oaths made in that 341, and those can also be a basis for denial of discharge. So please attend, and if Doug has questions, then you're there to answer them and follow up and be diligent that way. What was the other thing you touched on? the other one. I got so excited. Yeah, marital settlement agreements. You know, the X factor. We love the X factor. We get a lot of. We have a hotline. I don't think that's any secret. If there's an X out there and they have some information, chances are they'll share it with us. So get on the front end of that and make sure that what you're disclosing is true and that this debtor is disclosing everything that they own or did own in the recent past. You guys have to have questions.
Okay, so Amy, you said households appear to be growing, will be multi-generational. Why do you think that is?
The cynical answer is so they can pass the means test, because the more people you have, the higher your median income is to pass the means test. I had a case recently where the debtor claimed her grandson as a dependent, and she said she lived with her daughter and son-in-law. But the debtor forgot that, well, actually the debtor lied. She had a condo, and there was a tenant in that condo. Now, the story she told at the 341 was, I go back to the condo on weekends. When I looked at her bank statement, she's getting rent from the condo. Somebody's actually living in it. And she was just being generous to her son and daughter-in-law and child. They made $100,000 a year, but they needed to keep up the payments on their new Harley and new RV. So, you know, she just pulled everybody in to the household.
I think also what we're seeing is that boomerang generation, where kids are coming back to live in the household and then parents feel obligated to support them. But that moral obligation is not a legal obligation. And then that moral obligation is causing them not to pay their creditors, which is a legal obligation. And so when we look at that, we take the legal obligation viewpoint, not the moral, and that's, I mean, we've all done plenty of 2004s with crying parents about how we can't, these kids can't support themselves.
But then we get their tax returns, but then we get the kids' tax returns, and they're making $35,000 a year, and A, the parent has no idea the kid makes that much. I mean, I've had parents completely shocked that, because, you know, they only tell their parents, I don't have enough money. but the kids are the adult child will be paying his own his or her you know car insurance and car and whatever else he or she wants to spend that money on, but not contributing to the household in terms of food, cell phones, and the necessities of living. And by the way, if anyone knows the trick to getting your kids off your cell phone bill, please let me know. I've been trying that.
Ditto.
But I think the practice point here is, if you're going to include all of these people in your household, you have to have both a legal basis, and then if you do, and we have plenty of cases where there are, you need to include all of that income. And that's the practice point that we don't see, is we see all the people claimed, so you get all the benefits, but we don't see all the income claimed. So you're taking all the benefits, but you're also not including the income, which skews the whole test.
And I think Amy touched on this before, but we will ask for tax returns of those dependents that you're claiming. So, that's something to know as well.
Because if that child is paying some of the household bills, like paying the utilities, or taking on some of the obligations of the household, they might be part of the economic unit. But when they're not contributing to the household,
They're roommates. And that's the distinction that we're really trying to make, is roommates versus dependents. Just know that that issue is out there, and it's on the attorneys and the debtors to prove that they're dependents. And our role is to ask for the documents that prove that, when we see these large households of sometimes unrelated people. Well, we have 3 minutes. Do we have anything else? Yes, in the back. Yay!
I had a Chapter 7 recently where it was a roommate situation. And so on J, I listed half the rent and half the utilities and that she paid her own food, the roommate bought his own food, or whatever the situation was. And I explained that in the little box at the bottom. And then on the means test, it was household of one and her income.
Right.
And my Chapter 7 trustee tried to tell me that I should have included the contribution of the roommate on the means test. And I thought, I know the form sort of implies that, but no. And it didn't go any further. So I'm just curious if you have a comment.
But is the roommate contributing to the household, or they're just paying their own expenses?
That's my argument, that they're just paying their own expenses, and that roommate is paying half the rent, which is his obligation. I mean, they both signed the lease,
so
I presume.
It's the same result, right? So either, the roommate's making a contribution, or they're claiming half the expenses.
Well, that's the same result on I and J, but on the means test, it would increase her income.
I think, and that's actually kind of an interesting issue, because is she getting contributions for the rent?
That would be a fact. That's an interesting question, and that would be a fact-specific inquiry. I would look at, do they have a joint bank account?
No, these are roommates.
So there's really nothing. Yeah, I think we would probably just, depending on the case, not take that any further also, because it sounds like you did it right. That's the household of one, claiming only one. And then if the trustee made a referral to us, I think we just might call and just say, can you explain it? Mm-hmm. And make sure it all, pans out.
Okay, and when we're discussing adult children, I'm talking about children who are able-bodied, able to work. If you've got somebody who's disabled for whatever reason, just let us know. Hey, I think you should know this. This kid is sick. This kid has problems.
This judge is late. Sorry. Thanks, everybody, for coming. And thanks to the U.S. trustee and their staff attorneys and their analysts for giving us all this helpful information. Super.
Thank you.
I've got a joke for Vince.
He's back there.
How do you tell an introverted accountant from an extroverted accountant?
You can't.
The extroverted accountant looks at your shoes when he's talking. we're going to have another Lou Jones soon, and it's going to feature the judges. And we're going to talk about our new rules and our plans. And we feel we're going to have enough kind of time under our belts to talk about issues and problems and what concerns you have. So stay tuned to the listserv. Keep watching the website, and we'll announce when that's going to be. It's the next one we hope will feature the judges. If there's somebody else that Laura was so kind as to call and offer to do this program, if you've got an idea for a topic, just let us know. We'd be glad to reserve the room and put the show on. Thanks for everybody attending in Video Land, and see you next time.
We are up here if you all want to introduce yourselves to us, because we